and authority be chosen.
We agreed to the concept of a central leading authority, but we haven't yet done the studies to in consulting the native people and the communities or the bands and how this is to be set up. But while it would be a central Indian authority, a lot of its authority would more or less be that which is given to it by the villages. In other words, the bands would be the main landowners. In other words, all the land that's been selected would be held by the Indian bands. And this authority, while it will be worked on, we've got a study underway now to suggest to us how this should be set up. We haven't agreed to the details of how it would be set up in terms of and how it would choose its members and how it would be governed. The next element of our claim is dealing with land. Under lands, we have three different categories of land. We have lands for community purposes, we have rural lands, and we have site specifics. Community lands are those lands within existing communities. In other words, we have the 15 communities in the Yukon Territory, and a lot of the lands right now are held by the commissioner under the territorial government, but we've been permitted and they've agreed to transfer some of their lands to the bands. And the second category is the rural lands. These are large blocks of land surrounding the communities. For example, the lands in the south, the communities in the south, there are five communities in the south and have agreed to a land quantum of 0.86 square miles per person. And roughly works out to about approximately 500 square miles for the southern bands. And each band would hold approximately 500 square miles of land. In the north, they're a little more generous. They've agreed to 1.1, and this works out roughly between 600 and 700 square miles of land. And the far north, dealing with the lands in the Old Crow area, they've agreed to 8 square miles per person. In other words, in Old Crow, the community would own some 3,000 square miles of land, whereas in the south, you'd own approximately 300 to 500 square miles of land. These lands would be held in fee simple. They would be held by the band corporations. And only the improvements on the land would be taxed. In other words, if you build a house, only the value of the house would be subject to taxation. Whereas raw land would not be subject to taxation. And the other element of these lands is that while the lands would be available for sale to anybody, the lands cannot be subject to seizure for non-payment of taxes. The site specifics, we have a lot of cabins, we have a lot of fishing sites, we have grave Indian graves, and a lot of historical areas which have been really very important to the Indian people. And the government and the parties have agreed to set aside 2 to 6 hectares of land, in other words, to protect those areas, those fishing sites, the grave sites, the trapping cabins, and all those historical areas we have identified. And we have a lot of those. We have something like 70 sites per community. For example, Whitehorse would have their community lands, approximately 400 square miles of rural lands, and in addition to that, 70 or so site-specific areas to which would be held and owned by the band outright.
You mentioned the measurement by hectares. Can you convert that for us? We're in the United States. You don't use that, do you?
Yeah, the hectare is about 2.47 acres.
Thank you.
The last element of our claim deals with money compensation. Government has agreed to pay $183 million in 1980 dollars over a period of 20 years, and it works out to $620 million beginning in the year 1986. This money would be held in a trust corporation, and the trust corporation would have a total control over the monies. We have this would be set up under the existing laws. However, we've written in a number of things. For example, it would be tax-free for 10 years, and it would the investment won't be tied to what is now existing. We'd have a broader say in terms of how we can invest the money, as long as the money is used for Indian purposes, and this is quite broad. It's not limited to charitable or education, and we do have a lot of leeway in how the monies can be spent, and it won't be captured by the tax laws. We would have the break for 10 years, and after 10 years would be subject to the normal taxation. However, government says that in 10 years they believe this fund would be in terms $1.2 billion. And they said if we were to get it for 20 years, the trust corporation would become too powerful and would have a great monopoly in the Yukon territory in terms of the economic life of the Yukon. So while they sympathize with us, they can see the advantages in 20 years is that the Indian people will be one of the greatest landholders, and also one of through the Express Corporation become very powerful in terms of the economic life of the Yukon territory.
I have the feeling I've heard this before. Could you tell us how the Trust Corporation would be held? Who owns the Trust Corporation? How do they own it?
The Trust Corporation would be established under the existing laws. And right now, we believe the 12 bands would each have a share in the Trust Corporation. And would be managed centrally with subsidiaries. In other words, each band would have the right to set up a trust corporation to transfer funds from the central trust to their own trust, the band trust corporation. In other words, we have right now a study underway to determine how the details can be worked out to provide for more community control and less central control. In other words, the benefits should flow to the communities and not be held in the central level. There's strong pressures, especially from the financial houses, to hold the money centrally and to keep it invested. However, we've agreed that the money should go to the communities, and the communities should have a greater say in how the investment dollars are spent, how it should be kept and managed.
Mr. Parker says, is it a shareholder corporation or a membership corporation? You say the bands, the 12 bands will hold the shares.
Yes, the 12 bands would hold the shares in the corporation.
And the 12 bands are band councils elected by the Indians comprising each band under the Indian Act of Canada.
Yeah, well, it's not going to be under the Indian Act. That's one of the other things. Is that following the settlement in the Yukon Territory, we're going to preempt the Indian Act. In other words, the Indian Act won't apply in the territory. It would become inoperative. It'd still be the law of the land, but it won't be operative in the Yukon Territory. The bands would be incorporated under the Settlement Act, and the membership open up to all the beneficiaries who are registered with that band, and the people who are registered with the bands would then elect through their whatever means, in other words, their traditional means, would elect their leadership, and the leadership would then be the trustees and hold the shares for the members of each of the bands.
I see. Mr. Parker?
The band corporations would not be open to entry ever through sale of stock or any means.
Well, that's true. It's very clear that whatever shares or stocks that are held will always be held by the Indian bands forever. But the bands have the say as to who can become their own members. In other words, under our land claims agreement, the provision is that if a person is accepted as a member of the community, that person can be deemed a beneficiary by that band. In other words, the bands have full control over their membership, and they can determine who can become a member of their bands. But once you're a member, then you have full entitlement to the whole of the Yukon land claims. But unless you're a member, you have no say whatsoever.
Sheldon Ketchatag, do you have a question?
One of the problems that we have here in Alaska is the fact that all children born after December 18, 1971 are not included in the settlement. You mentioned the fact that this is an agreement with the bands. Now, is there a cutoff date on descendants, or will the descendants always be part of the bands and therefore sharing in on the settlement?
Yes, with respect to that, we dealt with that question at length, and it was finally agreed by the chiefs that it should be an open enrollment. In other words, the enrollment would last forever, and as long as you can trace your ancestry back to one of the charter groups, there is no cutoff date for enrollment. In other words, if you're born and descended Yukon Indian, you'll always be eligible for the claims. And there's no, we've not set a limit as to you have to be one quarter Indian blood. That hasn't been agreed to. A lot, as long as you can claim an nth degree descended to Yukon Indian, you're eligible in full membership with the claim.
Shorty O'Neill and Steve Iveson have questions, but just before we allow them to put their questions, I'm not sure you had completed what you intended to say. Had you?
No, not quite. Well, we've the eligibility is still wide open. In other words, the enrollment would last. There will be a registry kept, and that as children are born, they will be enrolled.
All right. Where were we? Shorty O'Neill.
In the beginning of your presentation, you talked about the COPE agreement. I'm not sure what COPE is, but you said it had a bad effect. And then you went on to say that the Alaskan agreement and the other agreements in Canada had some effect, but you didn't say what type of effect. So if you could answer that first, and then I have another question.
Yes, we... There are three parties to this negotiation in Yukon. There's the federal government, the territorial government, and the Indian people. And in dealing with the government, we've always had to argue against precedents set by other claims. In other words, in dealing with land, they looked at Alaska, we looked at COPE, we looked at the James Bay Agreement, and we looked at the treaty-making process in the South. In the South, when they signed treaties, I believe it was 1 square mile per family of five. And James Bay was a little more generous. I guess they got 1 square mile per family of four or something like that. And COPE was the most generous claim. They got over 14 square miles per person. We argued that COPE, while it's used as a precedent in terms of extinguishment of rights, that should be followed too in terms of granting of land. But you multiply 6,000 times 14, you get some 80,000 square miles of land. In other words, approximately one half the Yukon would have to be transferred to the Indian people. And this wasn't, so we had a very strong argument against us. While we're only one quarter of the population, on using the COPE formula, we'd be granted one half the Yukon territory. So we argued. But in terms of dealing with COPE and Alaska, government used these models in terms of really strong in terms of dealing with what is meant by Aboriginal rights. In other words, they said Aboriginal rights does not include subsurface resources. The Aboriginal rights doesn't include that. Aboriginal rights deals mainly with hunting and fishing and living off the land. So, but we argued that these shouldn't be held as precedents. And they've been used, you know, used by government in terms of dealing with the various elements of the claim. They always refer back to, well, in Alaska, under there's no hunting and fishing rights. You know, there's no subsistence rights there. Mm-hmm. Or in fishing or in trapping. Those type of things have always been used to argue against us. And I'm sure when the Yukon claim is settled, the Dene people will be arguing against the Yukon claim.
So it, in fact, did have some bad effects on the agreement or the discussions towards the agreement. You're saying that, eh?
There are some bad effects of previous agreements.
Yeah, the other thing that really concerns me is the amounts of money in these agreements, you know. And the less land, you know, it seemed to be a whole heap of money and not enough land because in reality we own a lot, you know. We didn't immigrate to this, you guys didn't immigrate to this country, I didn't immigrate to Australia. We own those countries by heritage coming from the beginning of time. And these great lots of money, and what we've found with the mining royalty equivalents in Australia is that you either end up with a couple of Aboriginals who have a, not a lot of money, but some heavy money for a little bit, or you end up with a whole lot of Aboriginal people who have a little bit of money for a little bit, but in a short time, what you find is there's a whole lot of rich lawyers, there's a whole lot of rich used car dealers, there's a whole lot of rich publicans, and there's a whole lot of damn broke Aboriginal people. And, you know, I'm just wondering how you see the effects of that money and less land.
Well, we're quite, you know, going back to the experience on James Bay, we're looking at that too. We've run into similar experience in terms of how to get the benefits back to the people and not benefit just simply a select group of people. For example, now we, just dealing in one area and dealing with housing, we're finding that our agreements aren't, while we're providing good houses to people, the employment doesn't go to our people because of the requirements that you have to have tradespeople who can give a seal of approval in terms of, for example, you have to have a certified electrician, a certified carpenter, a certified plumber, and all these people. In other words, instead of having Indian people build their own houses, you have to hire other people to build those houses. So we're finding that experience, and we're trying to figure out how to overcome that. And perhaps it's not too late for us to write in guarantees in terms of economics. I know in COPE they got a 10% preference. In the Yukon we've looked at that, but it's not appropriate. We're going to have to sign some type of agreement on economic opportunities that stem from the land claims, giving the Indian people of the Yukon Territory a preference. In spite of all those laws, general application, which stipulate that you have to have certified and well-qualified people.
The you said that on the basis of the COPE formula used in the Western Arctic, you would have wound up with half the land in the Yukon. You are 25% of the population, and under the agreement, you wind up with 25% of the land.
No, we don't end up with 25% of the land. We have. They've agreed that 8,000 square miles of land in Yukon Territory would be transferred to the Indian people. That's less than 5% of the total land mass in the territory.
Steve Iveson and then Rosita Wall.
You made a passing remark earlier that the Indian land could be sold to anyone. Do you want to enlarge upon that a little bit?
Under our agreement, the lands would be held in fee simple by the Band Corporations. And there's no stipulation as to whether or not you can alienate that land. There's no restrictions on alienation. In other words, each band would be the full owners of their lands and would have the full right to sell if they desire to sell their lands or if they want to keep it forever. In other words, there's no restrictions on that. The bands would have full management of their lands, and they have the right to sell to individual members of their bands or to sell to the general public at large.
Shorty O'Neill?
I'm amazed. Completely. Our experience not in Australia, but in the South Pacific, particularly with the Māori situation, through the Treaty of Waitangi, when 95% of a country was supposed to be handed to them, and the land was saleable, but it was put in hands of the chiefs. What's happened over the years, that was about 140 odd years ago, but that treaty was signed, and 95% of a country was handed over to the Maori people. What's happened since then, there's been a lot of imports of alcohol and a lot of drunk chiefs around, and a whole lot of land went down the creek, and I think they're on something like 3% of the total country at the present time. So something like 92% of their country has been sold out, mainly through alcohol, but many other things also. And I'm amazed that people are still accepting the right to sell their land in land claim settlements. In the past, wherever that's happened, we always find that the indigenous people are the ones who get ripped off.
Perhaps I can respond to you. Right now, the Yukon Territory, there's some 207,000 square miles of land, and approximately 300 square miles of that land is owned by the territorial government. The balance is held by the Crown and Right of Canada. But under the land claims agreement, there's also, we got a land use planning agreement, which states that we'll sit on a board that'll approximately 25% participation in that, and we'll deal with as land is being granted, we'll deal with the total land planning for the Yukon Territory. And when land is being granted and released to the public, each of the bands would have the full right to participate in the buying land. In other words, we're not restricted to the 8,000 square miles of land. We'll have the full right and the full benefits as Yukon citizens. In other words, we're trying to write in something that's happening in Alaska as land is being made available to the public. We're resident Alaskans, or pioneer Alaskans have certain benefits to first choice to buy land. That's more or less going to be the policy in the Yukon. We're trying to argue that that should be the policy in the Yukon Territory. As indigenous people who lived there over 30,000 years, we've built up enough preference that as land is being made available, we'll have a pot of money to start acquiring more lands for the territory, for the Indian people. We're not going to be in the business of selling land. I think we will be in the business of buying land.
I'd hope not. Hope it works that way.
Rosita Worrell?
I was telling Mike that I probably could trace some of my ancestry to that area. I understand.
And one enrollees.
Yes. I understand from your discussion that you have done away with the status and non-status distinction between Indian people. But for the record and for Alaskans, would you elaborate on those differences and how one moves from one to the other?
In Canada, we have three groups of people. We have the Inuit people, we have the Indian people, and we have the Métis people. There is an act passed under the Constitution, or the BNA Act, which recognizes Indian people. It provides for the management of Indian people and Indian lands. And under that act, it it sets up band structures, in other words, Indian bands. And if you're a member of a band, you become a registered Indian. And there was a census taken, and people were registered. It happened in 1948 when they came up to the Yukon Territory, started registering Indian people as members of bands and become, in other words, under the federal government, federal responsibility. During the period of time, a lot of people, for one reason or another, decided to become enfranchised. In other words, back in the early days, Indians weren't allowed to do a number of things. You couldn't vote, you couldn't go to public schools, weren't allowed to buy alcohol, and you weren't allowed to participate with the general public. In other words, you were restricted in terms of your rights. And as a result, a lot of people, either through the, made a decision to go into business or to go to public schools, decided to become full citizens of Canada and gave up their so-called Indian status. And as a result, we have a generation or two of non-status people, in other words, who are Indian people or whose parents, you know, for one reason or another, gave up their status and became enfranchised, they called it. And by becoming enfranchised, they gave up certain things as their hunting rights. They gave up their right to be a member of a tribe. They gave up their right to all the other benefits that are so-called, that have been granted Indian people. And as a result, we have two groups of people in Yukon Territory. We have the status Indians, who are approximately 3,000 to 4,000 members. And we have the non-status people, a little over 2,000 who are non-status. And over the years, the non-status people have not enjoyed any rights as Indian people. Well, they have all the, they've more or less lived like Indian people. They have all the disadvantages, live with all the disadvantages without the benefits. And after the bands in the territory decided to amalgamate. In other words, they opened up their membership. There are a couple of bands yet who haven't yet amalgamated. In other words, they're still wondering about it. But for the most part, in the Yukon Territory, all the bands have opened up their membership and treat each other equally, in spite of the laws of the land, in spite of the Indian Act and the government agents. They've decided that we're one people, we have full rights as Indian people, and we should share equally with your brothers and your sisters. And that was one of the hallmarks of the Yukon Indian people, is that we've did away, while the distinction exists in law between status and non-status people, in terms of dealing with ourselves, we treat each other as equals.
Can you tell me, was that movement to non-status always voluntary, or could it happen that through marriage to a non-native person that you would lose your status? And then once you were a non-status, was that irreversible, or could you go back to being a status?
Yes, that's the other way in which you can lose your status as an Indian person is through marriage to a non-Indian. In other words, an Indian woman, if you married a non-Indian or a non-status person, you lost your status as an Indian person. Whereas a non-status woman or a white woman or a non-Indian woman marries an Indian man, they acquire Indian status. So That's been a great issue in Canada, and it's one in which the governments have wrestled with this for a long time, and I think they say that they will change the law, but they still haven't done it. In other words, they promised every year to introduce legislation to do away with that discrimination, that you can lose your status by marriage, and they've promised, but they haven't yet delivered.
Yes, sir. Maureen Kelly.
So what I'd like to ask you then, What about the children? You're saying that a woman loses her status if she marries a white man. And what about the children of that union if they wanted to be a native of your country? They can't be?
The children of a mixed marriage, in other words, of a Indian woman and a non-Indian person would acquire a non-status. It would be a non-status.
So they don't have an identity, even though they have Indian blood in them?
Well, they're not recognized.
Sheldon, catch a tag.
Yes, I have three or four questions which are interrelated. First of all, in your negotiations, do the communities or the bands have the right to select or authorize you to negotiate on their behalf?
Yes, the negotiations. Right now we have a chief negotiator who works under the direct authority of the 12 chiefs. In other words, each community has a chief, and the chiefs sit on the board, and the negotiators report directly and receive all their instructions from the chiefs.
Okay. As far as the settlement, is it subject to the consent or the approval of the bands, or is it just related to the chiefs?
The settlement would be subject to the approval by the band membership. Each band has its own method of approving or disapproving the land claims package. In one community where the approval process, the band had a general meeting of the members, and they've held up their hands and voted in favor. In another community, they had a vote by secret ballot, and the voting lasted a complete week, where each member of the band, 16 years and over, and enrolled in that community, had the right to vote either in favor or against the agreement. And under our ratification process, we require 10 bands to vote in favor. In other words, each of the bands would look at the land claims package, and if only 9 bands voted in favor and 3 bands voted against, the whole package would be treated as being rejected.
As far as input from band members other than the chief, is there any mechanism provided to where your everyday Indian in the village would have any say or input into the negotiations on concerns or items which he would like to be inserted into the settlement?
In the actual negotiations, that doesn't really happen. However, the negotiators have been required to go to the communities and report and give updates on the land claims negotiations. And this is open to the general band membership and each member of the community. If they're interested in the land claims, attend the meetings, ask questions, express their concerns, and if the concern is generally felt by all the members of the community, in other words, the majority feel that the decision with respect, say, on hunting is wrong, then the negotiators have to go back and make changes.
In that same regard, are your sub-agreements also subject to either chief or band member input?
Yes, all our agreements, before they're actually signed, there's full consultation with the chiefs. And it's mainly dealing with the chiefs in terms of negotiations. Sometimes it goes back to the communities. In other words, if the issue is important enough and it affects the individual person, then there's reporting back to the bands. But whereas the concept is pretty straightforward in terms of, say, for land, in other words, land quantum, then mainly deal with the 12 chiefs.
What part did the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act have in regard to each band or community making sure that they have an official delegate from their band to enter into negotiations? One of the problems which I have heard concerning ANCSA is the fact that it was not negotiated by official representatives of the tribal governments. Now, did this have any bearing on the process which you went through with your communities or bands?
I really don't know. You see, that's one of my regrets, is I wasn't here when the Alaskan people made their presentation on the Alaska Claims Settlement. But in the Yukon Territory, There's always been an element of local control, and one of the communities are very jealous of their authority. And every time we make presentations or talk about in terms of central Indian government or the Trust Foundation, one of the points that is always made very clear to the negotiators and to the Indian leadership is that the communities have to remain in full control of whatever is happening, and the benefits must flow to the communities. For example, our CYI, the executives, the leadership, are elected by general population. In other words, each Yukon Indian registered with the Council for Yukon Indians, another 16 years and over, you have the right to vote or to run for office. And every 2 years, the leadership has to go to the general public, and each member of the community has the full right to vote in any election.
In that regard, what guidance do you take from your chiefs, and do the elders of your village have any bearing on the overall outcome?
Yes, the chiefs have a great deal of authority over the council. They have the full management and full authority of the total organization. In other words, they're the governing body. The elders are involved. We have we're gradually getting the elders to attend meetings. We've written into that one of the executive members should be an elder, that the elders would sit on the board with the chiefs, the elders would be involved in the band governments, and we've written into and entrenched in our organization, you know, full involvement of elders, not only advisory, but also full voting authorities.
And what say do the communities or bands have in the final form of the settlement? In other words, if in fact the Yukon Territories and the Canadian government decided that the settlement will go not to the tribal governments but to provincial chartered corporations, would that be subject to the approval of the tribal or band government?
Yes, it is, and the bands do still have full authority in that. In the event that this agreement in principle is not acceptable, they would throw it out.
Sorry, Shorty O'Neill and then Steve.
Sheldon asked a question that I was going to ask.
Okay, Steve Iveson and then Steve Keckley.
I have a question to the floor, but maybe to Doug Saunders, maybe he could answer it here. Is that, as I understand it, it's the Indian Act which determines that women lose their status by marrying a non-native person or a non-registered person, and then their offspring as well. And that also the Constitution, a clause in the Constitution will come into effect in the near future, which will cause that section of the Indian Act to be inoperative. Now that applies only, I presume, to women who marry after that comes into place, is that correct, and their children? Mm-hmm. Also, there was a special committee of the House of Commons that produced a report that talked about amending the Indian Act to let women and their first generation children back on to get their status back, although perhaps not automatically to get back into the bands. Do you have any information as to what the government is actually intending to do in that regard?
Okay.
One of Canada's leading authorities on this question of status and non-status Indians, and it's of interest because the division here in Alaska between the generation that holds shares and the next generation that does not hold shares may portend some consequences that we've lived through in Canada. But this is something you don't need, believe me.
Well, I will be very brief. The membership system historically was developed after the reserve system had been developed and was designed to regulate who could reside on reserves and who could not. And it used the male as the head of family to give the same status to all members of the nuclear family. It didn't tie into Indian traditional kinship. It related most closely to European patterns of kinship. It's been a very intense subject of political controversy in Canada for about 15 years. There is controversy at this point whether constitutional amendments in 82 and 83 have finally prohibited that sexual discrimination. The federal government announced in the speech from the throne, the last speech from the throne, that they would introduce legislation. Monroe has said that will be done before summer, and last week the Prime Minister distributed a two-page a statement giving some detail. There's still some fuzziness about retroactivity. One of the fundamental problems, however, has been that most of the Indian organizations have been demanding their own control over the determination of membership. And so there have been two separate agendas which haven't interacted with each other very successfully. Because most of the federal proposals, including that of the committee that you referred to, have built into them a kind of assumption that you will still have a national system of determining who is a status Indian and who is not. Whereas the organizations are saying that is a fundamental error. One of the basic rights recognized in the United States, at least in the lower 48, has been the right of the tribes to determine their own membership. The government, that's only at this point an agenda item in terms of discussions in Canada. There's really been no advancement to recognizing that as a right of tribal groupings.
Steve Iveson.
So then, if the retroactive clause changed Indian Act does not go ahead, and if it were found that the present constitution will have effect on equality, will effectively cause equality to occur, that will then be from now on, is that correct?
It would be from 82, from the amendments of 82, that would be in effect. That would not produce any retroactivity going before 1982. That could be done by the federal government by legislative change, and they are proposing that people who have lost status, people who had status at one point and lost it and are still alive, that those people would be eligible. Therefore, you could not get status if you never had it, but your mother did at one point. So that's the major limitation that the federal government have talked about when they have been positive on retroactivity issues.
Steve Cackley.
Yeah, I have one question, I think, but it has to do with a couple of points that Mark R. Gordon made this morning. One, that when he and the other Inuit leaders in northern Quebec delivered to their people a package, there was created a dissident group. In your case, the question is there potential of the same thing happening? Is that in that, will there or is there possibly now a possibility that a number of the communities may not accept the package as is, and if so, what are the possibilities of going back to the table to negotiate on their behalf? And the second point is, the second question, which is related to that, is the package as it is now, does that have the support, the personal support of the CYI leadership involved in negotiations? And when it becomes time for ratification, are you all going to personally endorse the package, or are you going to step back and say, well, it's people's choice, and not vote on it?
Yes, and dealing with, first of all, first dealing with, you say, a dissident group, there's no question in our mind there's a great deal of, a great many people in Yukon Territory who've reviewed the claims agreement and who also think in terms of the question of extinguishment of Aboriginal rights, who are strongly opposed to that. You know, I don't know what percentage of the Northern Quebec Inuit who were opposed to the claims package there. However, in Yukon, the dissident groups have a lot of sway. Would have a lot of sway in the overall question of ratification, because the way our ratification is written, there has to be an overwhelming support for the package for it to be approved. In other words, 10 of the 12 communities have to vote in favor. Say, for example, right now, we know very clearly there are at least three bands who are opposed to the land claims for various reasons. One is that they disagree with the extinguishment. Secondly, they don't agree with the land quantum. That question is it's outstanding. There are two communities yet who have not come to the table to negotiate their land selection or land quantum. And so we do have a lot of problems in terms of trying to provide a claims package that has everyone's blessing. And in our view, the test of this claims package is very high. You know, you need 10 of the 12 communities. And right now, our guess is that we don't have it. With respect to where the CYI leadership stands in the settlement offer, we'll know very shortly where they stand, because we have election coming up in approximately 2 months, and there's no doubt that this claims offer would be a central issue. And the whole question of extinguishment and where people stand will come out. In other words, all the people who are running for the leadership will have to make a stand, because the community people will demand it. And on the basis of that, I think it's going to be a very clear question to the people of Yukon Territory where they stand. And it's a very good process.
The, it, I,